Welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. With me, as always, is Eric Steven. Eric.
Hello.
The Dodgers are 45-21. They are in first place in the National League West, ahead by 11 games. That's a lot, Eric.
Yeah, and they're in first place in the MLB as well as
baseball.
Right, the MLB, as people call it. Yeah, they're good. I feel weird because, like, at some point last week, it was the second win in Arizona. So the Dodgers at that point had won 7 straight. And, you know, over the years, predictions are a fool's errand, you know, or like declarations, because it doesn't serve anybody. Like, are you going to gloat that you had something right that was so obvious? Like, but I was like, after that second win against the Diamondbacks, like, I was just looking at the rest of the division, and I've sort of thought this for a little while, but like I generally, in True Blue LA, in the comment section, it's, I don't know what started this, honestly, but it's been a tradition of sorts that I always post the We Win photo from the end of Cheers, or maybe it's the beginning, I forget. Old timey photo with the guy holding up We Win. And that's just been sort of a tradition anytime the Dodgers win. So that I've kept it up, even though like I only write like once a week there. But I try to add like sometimes a subject line just to like for a joke or something. But in this subject line, when I put the We Win photo, I put the division or the National League West has been decided. like it's over. And then I check the timestamp, and literally within seconds, and I didn't notice this till like a half an hour later, but Purveyor of Doom and Bob Nightingale tweeted out like congratulations to the Dodgers on their 7th consecutive NL West, and I was like, oh no, like here's the thing, like jinxes aren't real. I laugh at people who are scared of jinxes or anything like that, but at the same time, it's not that Bob Nightingale's a jinx. It's just he's just really bad at like tweeting. Like he tweets in like this this style that's so like absolute or like I don't know. He assumes far too much, and he's wrong way too often. Like to be that certain of things. So like, and the fact that he just the way like he talked, like there's more to the tweet. I don't even have it up, but I was just like, this is bad. And then, of course, they've lost like the next 2 games, but who cares? It's irrelevant. They are going to win the division. But it was just like, I just felt like I had to do it at the exact minute that Bob Nightingale did it. It was like, oh, that made me feel really bad.
You know, we got so ingratiated by talking about how great the Dodgers are, we forgot the Cody Bellinger update.
Right. And it's funny, like they're still sort of humming along. They won 2 series last week. We didn't record last week. It was like a mix, like I was not feeling well, but also it was like a mix of there wasn't like much to talk about. It was like the same old thing kind of, and we didn't really have a hook as much last week. This week we have a lot of hooks and we're chock full of stuff, so it's kind of good that we took a week off, I think. But it's weird that while the Dodgers are still sort of humming along, like Cody Bellinger's kind of slumping right now. So our Cody Bellinger pace update, he's back down to like human levels. Like right now he's on pace for 49 home runs and 132 RBIs. So like the 49 home runs would tie a Dodger record, Sean Green. So it's not anything to sneeze at, certainly, but it's not the like superhuman stuff that he was on pace for earlier. So it just goes to show you that season is a long time. Slumps happen. He's over his last 11 as we record this on Monday. 4-for-25 to start June. He was walked intentionally 3 times on Saturday. So, and we'll get to that in a little bit, because we're going to talk about sort of the byproduct of that and someone who sort of benefited from that. But yeah, so he's slowing down. He's to the point where he was leading like the majors in most offensive categories for a long time. and then mostly leading the National League too, just as he sort of waned down. But like now, like Christian Yelich has gotten hot again, so he's passed him in some things. I think Cody Bellinger, as of Monday morning, was like leading in batting average and on base percentage, but Yelich leads in a lot of other stuff. So Cody Bellinger still having a very great season, obviously, but winding down a little bit and getting to more sort of normal levels. But we expected that, but it's still great.
He's just a good sport, letting Yelich get back in there.
You know what? You're right.
You'll see. So let's go ahead and talk about, you hinted at it, Corey Seager, looking like the Corey Seager of old. And absolutely. By old, I mean, you know, 22, right. 23.
Right. Yeah. He's still like on the far on the right side of 30. So like, it's funny to talk about that. You're right. But, you know, he basically lost like a year and a half of like productive baseball with his elbow injury. He got hurt in like, I was looking back at the old like notes from 2017, and it started like he started feeling something like elbow soreness, I guess, in a series in Detroit in August. That was an eventful series because, just parenthetically, like the Dodgers acquired Curtis Granderson that weekend. They sent down a slumping Jock Peterson to the minors, and like Justin Verlander like nearly no hit them on Sunday, right before he got traded, and not to the Dodgers, as you might have heard. He got traded to some team. I forget what happened. Pretty much since then, like he sort of slumped to end 2017. He actually had a non-elbow injury. He had a back injury that he missed the NLCS in 2017, but he played in the World Series. But then he dealt with the elbow again during the spring of 2018, played for about a month, and then he had Tommy John surgery and missed the rest of the year. So, and then he started out slumping this year. So it was like, oh man, is Corey Seager two-time? It was two-time All-Star MVP, I think third place finisher as a rookie, one of the best players in baseball, and he wasn't up to that level until basically now. Like since like the beginning of May, he's just been on fire. This last weekend, like the Dodgers were on a road trip, he had at least one hit in every game. I think he had four multi-hit games. He has a 7-game hitting streak. He's reached base 18 games in a row. He was 12 for 26 on the road trip with 9 RBIs. He had 5 doubles. In that game that Cody Bellinger walked, was walked intentionally 3 times, Corey Seager was batting behind him and was 4 for 5 and drove in 4 runs. So did not work as well as the Giants had planned. Although to the Giants' credit, somewhat, like, these weren't like automatic, like old school, like immediate intentional walks. I think every single one of them happened once Bellinger got a favorable count. Like, I think all of them were like 3-0 or 3-1 when they called for the intentional walk. So it wasn't like a complete like surrender at that point to the bat. It was just like they realized they were in a disadvantageous position. So that's what they did. But yeah, so like Seager, what is he like? So since May 1st, 303, 370, 555. So that's great. You know,
numbers. Yeah,
you're right. Exactly. And for me, like, I think what I always look at for him, like he's hit over 20 home runs twice. And like, it's funny, like only one Dodger shortstop ever did that. And I'm talking about home runs. That's a shortstop. Hanley had a year where he hit 20, but he had like one as a DH or something. So I think he had 19 as a shortstop. So it didn't count. But like entire franchise history, Dodgers had one shortstop at 20 home runs. And then Corey Seager came along and did it in his first two seasons. Like, so he's unique in like Dodgers history. But I don't look at home runs for him necessarily. The home runs will come, and he has 8 this year. That's fine. But he has 20 doubles. He's always been a doubles guy. Like, he, the first month he came up in 2015 in September, he hit 8 doubles. That he hit 40 as a rookie. He had 30 heading into that fateful weekend series in Detroit in 2017. And it was through like 110 games. So it's basically like the 2/3 mark of the season. So he's on pace for like over 40 doubles again in his second year. And then now this year he has 20 and he's on pace for 49 doubles. So like that's where Seager is as a hitter when he's going well. He's going to rack up the doubles, and then the home runs will happen as well. But It's been really, it's great to see. Like, they started out hot, you know, during the season without, like, Seager or Justin Turner really hitting. And now both Seager and Turner are hitting, and it really transforms that lineup into, like, a far, far more potent one.
Dodgers had, since we last recorded, two really key home runs or storyline home runs that we should talk about. Do you want to talk about Will Smith, or do you want to talk about Max Muncy first?
Let's go Max Muncy first, only because it's fresh in my mind, and it's in my mind, and I wrote about it for SB Nation on Sunday, but it's the quote of the year in baseball, and it's not going to be topped. Like, it was hilarious, and it was fun, and I loved everything about it. So we'll just set the stage here. Sunday, the Dodgers finished up a series in San Francisco. They won the game 1-0, and the one run was a first inning home run by Max Muncy. And that alone, it was a splash hit, which I think the Dodgers have had 8 since Oracle Park, now on its 4th name, has opened. It's been open for, this is its 20th season. Muncy has the last 2 of those. He did one in the last weekend of the season last year, too. But that home run, first inning, was the only run of the game. As he's rounding first, Madison Bumgarner was the pitcher. He was sort of jawing at him. And then Muncy went back at him. And at the time, we just see the home run and we're like, oh, this is fun. Like, we have no idea what's happening. But then after the game is when the real magic happened, because Max Muncy was interviewed by Alana Rizzo, and that's when he was able to deliver the goods.
So, yeah, I've got a clip third of that.
By the way, okay, there seemed to be some exception to Madison Bumgarner on that home run. What exactly was the exchange there? What do you think happened?
Well, he, I hit the ball, and then he yelled at me. He said, don't watch the ball, you run. And I just responded back, if you don't want me to watch the ball, you can go get it out of the ocean.
Did you?
Now, your instructions to me were very specific that you wanted Alana Rizzo's laugh in the recording. So I hooked you up, Eric.
Yep. It's the best part. Well, I don't know if it's the best part of the clip, because Muncy's quote was so great.
It's an important ingredient.
But it's
in
so part, like, yeah. Right. Like, that's the whole point of this. Like, it's all fun, right? Like, it's not, it's like, it was hilarious. Like, she was taken, like, aback by the answer, clearly. And she just reacted like a normal human would and laughed. And it was great. But the quote itself, I will just read it here because I wrote it down. I know we all just heard it. But Muncy said, I hit the ball, and then he yelled at me. He said, don't watch the ball, you run. I just responded back, if you don't want me to watch the ball, you can go get it out of the ocean. there's a lot of things about this that are great. I've seen a lot of people comment, like, it's not even an ocean out there, it's just the bay. I think that's semantics at this point. He could have called it a pond. He could have called it anything, but he has poetic license. I think he could refer to any body of water, whatever, to whatever you want. The whole point of his sort of thing was, if you don't want me to, like, watch my home runs, don't give up a home run, is the gist of that quote. And it was beautiful. Like, it was great. Like, look, Madison Bumgarner, he has a history of sort of being a red ass. I'm not here to like disparage Bumgarner. I don't think, because, like, I think that's part of the fun too. And a lot of times, like, and Bumgarner's kind of said this after the game. There was a lot of, like, quotes of him that were parsed a little bit from after the game. I think the one that got the most play was, I think, from Andy Baggerly tweeted this. Bumgarner said, "I can't even say it with a straight face, but the more I think about it, I should just let the kids play." And parenthetical here, that's the, like, MLB, like, marketing slogan this year. They had a commercial at the beginning of the season showing a lot of the young stars. But so back to Bumgarner. But I can't. They want to let everybody be themselves, but then let me be myself. That's me. It seems like reading that in text, it seems like he's, like, petulant, right? Like I want the right to, I don't want, I, you know, I don't want anyone else to celebrate. I want my being me is, like, quashing squashing other people's celebrations. That said, I finally saw the actual, like, the video of Bumgarner in the clubhouse, and he was like smiling as he said it. There was no like attitude or anything. He was having fun with it, and I think that's the general theme of this. And I think a lot of the reaction is a lot of just Dodgers and Giants people going back and forth, going, "You suck," that kind of a thing. But like, I think it's part of the game, and it was hilarious. That's what I love about it. Like, the other stuff is ancillary and stupid. Like, Aubrey Huff and Jeremy Affeldt, both former Giants, both former teammates of Bumgarner, both like basically had some variation of like, "Max Muncy, what are you doing? There's a reason nobody charges Bumgarner, bro. He'll kick your ass." You know, it was that sort of tweet, and like, that's just stupid nonsense. But to me, like, the fun of it is what made it the quote of the year. Like, it's like baseball players expressing emotions on the field is great, and that kind of stuff makes for a very, especially in a rivalry game, made it very fun. And the quote itself is hilarious, and I love every part about it. And I hope everyone else does too.
Speaking of fun, how excited are you that we got a quick glimpse of it? How many puns you get to make over Will Smith joining the major league club? Is it too easy for you? Is this fish in a barrel territory where it's just not fun that it's that easy, or are you still relishing this opportunity?
I get super excited about it because, like, well, hey, it's overload at some point, right? The more you think about it, like, there's so many potential like puns made. Then at the same time, in my head, I'm like, well, a lot of people are going to be making these, so I don't want
to. I beat you to the punch on this podcast two weeks ago.
You machine gunned several movies references into a intro, and that was fun, and that was perfect. Like, that's how you do it, right? Like, but so in my head, I try to be like, I try to come up with something relatively different or new.
You gotta go to the deep cuts.
Yeah, and I'll look. I'm not above the stupid reference dump on. That's how that's my main bread and butter. Like, you know, I'll mention, you know, oh, like, there's a hitch in his delivery, that kind of thing. Yeah, that it's just stupid, just dumb one-off kind of joke puns. But at the same time, I try to be as creative as I can about it and try to go for not the obvious one when it seems like there's a lot of people making the obvious one. So it offered a little bit of a challenge. The one thing I liked that I did the most was the day he was called up, or maybe it was the day before, because I think it was on an off day. But I don't know. I spent like a half an hour looking this up, and I was trying to find the right I want to do a 6 degrees of separation thing,
sure.
Because
I thought I wanted to work that in too, and I just couldn't.
Yeah, and so I was thinking 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. So I was trying to find a way to link someone to Will Smith in 6 degrees, and there was a lot of ways to do it in fewer than six. So I had to sort of find a way to drag it out, and I found a minor league pitcher whose first name is Donald. I think it's Gunnell is his last name, but his middle name is Sutherland. So Donald Sutherland, parentheses Gunnell, was how I sort of framed it. I couldn't find any other I was looking for if there was someone like named DJ Jeffrey, that would have been the ultimate, but there was not. But so I found a way to link this picture to Will Smith in 6 degrees. And so I just tweeted that out with a picture and then a picture of Donald Sutherland and Will Smith from the movie 6 degrees of Separation. I thought that was funny. It got like two laughs, which is like normal, which is fine. But like, as long as I make myself laugh, that's usually my sort of standard for these.
You could do 6 degrees of Kevin Brown. Probably.
Oh, man.
Like, how quick could you get to Will Smith from Kevin Brown? Two?
I mean, if we're just, yeah, like, because there's, well, I'm trying to think here now. So what's the, I guess, yeah, because you could go like Kevin Brown in 03, right, was who was on the 03 Dodgers that was on the 06 Dodgers? Because you just have to link it to Russell Martin.
Oh, that's right.
And just like, I'm not looking this up, but I'm just trying to think in my head. there had to be like a reliever or someone who was there from 03. But off the top of my head,
I'm happy to cheat.
I cannot think of a pitcher who lasted. Derek Lowe.
I can do it in one. I can do it in one. Dave Roberts.
Oh, that's perfect. God, you're good. That's really good. That's excellent. I love everything about that.
Well, there we go. So we should talk about the player, not just his name, huh?
What?
made quite the impression in his 10 days up.
I would say that, like, the one thing about having the week off, it offered a little bit of like larger perspective in that we both were, if I remember right, weren't we? We recorded before he was actually called up, or maybe he was called up later that day. So we, in between recordings, he was both called up and sent back to the minors. So we got the full, like, sort of first stint experience. But like, it was just like we talked about, right? With Barnes down, they needed someone to sort of take the load at catcher. And that was
play
not
like
gonna
60%
be,
of the starts, roughly.
Right. And that was not going to be Rocky Gale. And so that's why they called Smith. And he performed admirably. Like, he started 6 of the 10 games, because right when Austin Barnes was eligible to return, he did. Smith, he started 6 of the games. He hit a walk-off home run in one of them. He doubled in his debut game. And then he also hit a home run in his last game in Arizona. So like, he did really well. Like, you know, what else do you expect, right?
Got some compliments from Clayton Kershaw, and just in general how he sort of his serious demeanor.
Oh, right. And like, everyone sort of likes how he catches, like, and they brought him up last September to get him like acclimated with just the clubhouse and the procedure, sitting in on the pitcher catcher meetings, that kind of stuff. So he's like, as he's a big part of the team, whether he's here or not. But yeah, so he was good. He threw out, and we talked about like minor league stolen bases, another sort of weird sort of translate, but it just seemed like there a lot of people were running on him, but that could also be the running on the pitchers. And it sort of proved that like he threw out 2 or 4 runners, but he really threw out 2 or 3, because in that last game, I forgot who the runner was, but Kenta Maeda was not paying attention. I think it was Maeda, and like just completely didn't pay attention to the runner. And he stole second base without a throw, and I think he even stole it standing up, which is ridiculous. Like, but so that counts against Will Smith's like stolen base stats. But in reality, he threw out 2 or 3 runners, which is excellent. So small sample size, obviously, but he did really well. And like, I don't know what you can expect more of him. And the issue too is like, once Barnes came back, they could have carried 3 catchers, because, you know, they used Matt Beatty a lot, starting him and pinch hitting him. But then he went on the DL with a, what did he have? Hip flexor. And they could have had 3 catchers for a temporary time. But I think the thought was they weren't really going to, if Barnes is back, they'll go back to Barnes and Martin. So Smith is basically like a pinch hitting role at that point. And so they'd rather have him playing almost every day in AAA. So that's what the reasoning was sort of behind his getting sent down. It did allow for Kyle Garlick, who came up in place of Beatty. It allowed Kyle Garlick to make his first major league start over the weekend. He actually got a pinch hit double for his first major league hit the day before. So it allowed for that. But so Will Smith back in the minors. But I would imagine he's definitely going to be up in September. But if they have another injury type thing now that he's on the 40-man, I think you see him called up whenever they need a catcher.
Real quick, I have a question for you about Will Smith. But Garlick, how happy are you about – man, you can't
This can't is the miss. Golden age. It really is. Like, it's perfect. Like, and again, trying not to like I think my best Garlick puns – okay, so there was 2 things. He had the double. He had the double on Saturday. On Friday night in the 9th inning, the Dodgers lost that game. But he came up in the 9th inning, and he flew out. And I tweeted, San Francisco is used to Garlick fries, not Garlick flies. And that got a little bit of run. That was fun. But then the best part, too, was a couple weeks ago when he was in the minors, he made this, like, ridiculous catch, like, in foul territory. I think he went over the wall. or like over a short wall or something. And I think MILB tweeted it out or something. And I just tweeted out just a dumb joke that just said the batter was Doug Vampire. And so that got a little fun run as well. But again, like I said, stupid humor, that's my game. And having Will Smith and a player named Garlic on the team, it's too much. So
with Will Smith, going back real quick, is there a world where outside of injury, Will Smith is the Dodgers' primary catcher this year?
You would have to have I don't see it. It would have to have like a horrendous like Austin Barnes slump, and I'm trying to think, like, I think they're going to be active, like trying to get trade for relievers. But for the life of me, I can't figure out the magnitude of a trade. Not that it's like a blockbuster or anything, but one that would like compel them to trade Austin Barnes to get a reliever, like that. I'm having a hard time thinking about that. I mean, it could very well could happen, or, you know, but I think they're very happy with Barnes catching. And like, he's fine offensively. Like, I think he'll be fine. So I don't think they're going to give that up unless it's for some major upgrade. And I don't know who's out there that would be that kind of a major upgrade. Like, maybe if they needed a starting pitcher and one of the bigger names, like a Noah Syndergaard or someone like that, you know, came up, and maybe Barnes has to be a part of that deal. Maybe that's the case, but like, other than that, I don't know if I see Barnes getting traded. So, and that's really the only way that that Will Smith would be the regular catcher, I think.
Sort of a similar situation with AJ Pollock, maybe close-ish to coming back. In the right before he went on the IL, the big question was, how are the Dodgers going to make sure to get Verdugo playing time? Because right now he's sort of filling in for all the outfield spots, a lot of center field, just because AJ Pollock would be given a little bit more than regular rest. And then that, as is often the case with baseball, problem, quote unquote, solved itself when Pollock going to the IL. When Pollock coming back, Dave Roberts seems to be adamant that he's getting the starting job back. How do you see this playing out with Verdugo? Are they just going to get super, super creative? Is this more of an honorific Dave Roberts is throwing the Pollock, but he actually might sit more often than he's letting on?
Yeah, that's what we sort of thought. You know, it's going to take a while for Pollock to get like platooned or benched or something. He's going to get a lot of rope because he's a veteran, and like he's not as bad as I think he was hitting in the first month or so. But yeah, it's what we said. Like, the quote from Dave Roberts, I was looking at this from the beat writers in Arizona, because he was asked about it. Robert said, right now, as we sit here, I expect AJ to play center field. There's something to keeping guys comfortable, and we're definitely fine with AJ there. So it'll go back to like basically just Verdugo spelling guys. Like, Pollock will still get days off, and Verdugo will start. They're more okay with Verdugo facing lefties. So maybe when Jock sits against a lefty, it's not always like Chris Taylor or someone starting in left. Maybe occasionally Verdugo gets that. Or if Bellinger needs a day, or if Muncy or Turner need a day, and then Bellinger has to play first, although he really hasn't played first since he hurt his shoulder, maybe Verdugo gets a day there. So I think they'll just find a way for him. But his playing time is going to be
with
reduced.
The Dodgers' flexibility, it's just so easy. You can almost construct a roster, and I think you can, where you just give one of the regulars a day off, you know, every 8 days, every 9 days, and somehow there's a spot that Verdugo can play in.
Right, and it's like sometimes even more with that. So they could get creative. Like, you're right. Like, if almost anyone goes out, it doesn't matter. Like, Verdugo could replace them indirectly, or, you know, somehow. Like, if Corey Seager went out, then like Kike could play short, and then they
Muncy
might
play
Muncy at second, and then
Bellinger at first, and
right,
then all
and
of a sudden,
exactly. Right, and then so, and, but then, you know, who, that's just, they have all sorts out, and that's how they sort of built it, which is good for them. But yeah, so yeah, but I think so. Verdugo's playing time is definitely going to go down, but we're still like, I would imagine a month away, something like that. I think the so the thing with you know, he's training Pollock, AJ Pollock is training at Camelback Ranch. So anytime the team comes through to play the Diamondbacks at Chase Field, the rehabbing guys meet up with the team. They're with the team like for the series, and that was the case with Pollock. And there was a funny story. I think Jorge Castillo in the LA Times wrote about it. First day there, Pollock, who was with the Diamondbacks his whole career, he wasn't he got lost like going to the visitors clubhouse because he had never been there. So like I thought that was kind of funny. Like and I'll say this, I've only covered a few games there, but it is it's a weird downstairs. It's like a it's pretty massive, and I kind of understand how he got lost if he especially if he was used to one way for like 7 years or whatever. So it was just kind of funny though that he's been there forever, and then he's like, oh crap, where am I? You know, that kind of a thing. But yeah, so he the update was he has a catheter like in his elbow. It's called a PICC line. I forgot exactly what that stands for, but it's supposed to come out of his elbow, quote unquote, soon. And I take that to mean like in the next week or two. But Roberts was even saying like he's going to need 40 to 50 like rehab at bats to be ready. Probably some of that's coming at Camelback Ranch, but then he'll go on like a minor league rehab assignment too. So I think like it seems like early July is the best bet for him. So we're still like almost a month away. So I don't think it's something that we have to necessarily worry about right now.
One other injury update we need to go through. Less optimistic. Tony Cingrani done for the year.
Yeah, this sort of came out in the in between for us recording 2 weeks ago. The Dodgers, he was on a rehab assignment, and then they shut him down because of his shoulder. And it turns out like he needs to have arthroscopic shoulder on surgery, so he's out for the year. That's unfortunate because, like you said, when he was healthy, like he was one of the Dodgers. He was the Dodgers' like best non-Kenley reliever, and he just hasn't been healthy for like you know a year basically at this point. So it's sad, and it really, especially when the Achilles heel of the team right now, even though they're performing very well, is the bullpen, and they could use all the help they can get, but it's not going to come from Cingrani at this point.
Before we started recording, you let me know you have two subjects that you have, diatribes, rants, soliloquies, I don't know. You wanted to talk about, since the Dodgers had that six-game losing streak, of which I got a witness in person.
That's right.
You're welcome. The Dodgers have been phenomenal. Like, out of this world, best team in baseball, good. And still probably not as good as two previous streaks, two or three previous streaks that the Dodgers had over the last couple of seasons, and you wanted to talk about that.
Absolutely. So I just want to say, too, you were at the game in St. Louis, the last of the four-game series when they got swept, and it was the fourth of six straight losses. But you also, not to sell yourself short, you also got to see Walker Buehler's only hit this season.
It was a good one.
So, yeah, it was a home run. But, yeah, so, like, they fell to 8-8 after that six-game losing streak. Since then, they're 37-13. Like, that's dumb. Like, that's like an NBA record, you know?
Yeah.
It's a 740 winning percentage. So it's like you're essentially talking about, like, a 60-win team. So basically congrats to the Dodgers who are playing, like, the Raptors right now. But it just it goes to show you how, like, insane those two runs they had. And the fact that they had two runs in, like, a five-year span is even more insane. Like, we look back at 2013, the Dodgers off to that horrific start, right? They were 10 games under 500. They were, like, considering, like, they were very close to, like, firing Don Mattingly just because they didn't know what else to do. Like, they were talented but just weren't playing. And then they went on that ridiculous run. And so the main part of it was they were 42-8 over 50 games. So at the time, nobody had done that good over 50 games since the 1942 Cardinals. Like, so that's crazy. Like, that's like an insanely good streak. Like, and it's 840 winning percentage. That's even better than like NBA, you know, most NBA teams. And then lo and behold comes 2017 when the Dodgers actually got off to like a goodish start. Like they were fine, right? Like when their sort of streak started, they lost, I think, to the Nationals, and they were 35-25. Like, that's a perfectly good, like, record to have, right? Like, in a normal season, you would take that like nine times out of 10. In fact, it's a 94 and a half win pace over a full season. So it's like, that's a good team, right? And then after they went after they were 35-25, they went 43-7. they had this ridiculous 42-8 run that couldn't be topped, and then they topped it, and they even extended it to like 52-9. But only four teams ever have gone 43-7, and the last one before the Dodgers was the 1912 New York Giants. So like, that's crazy. Like that doesn't happen. And like, I know a lot of people anytime the Dodgers slump, they're like, yeah, what if they can go on this 42-8 or 43-7? The answer is they can't. Like, that's we have to appreciate how good and how insane it was to be able to witness that, because it just doesn't happen in baseball history. And 37-13 is like awesome. It's still like not close to that. that's what made those runs so good. And even if you just shorten it down a little bit, the Dodgers are 19-5 since May 12th. And that's a 792 winning percentage, so not quite 800. That's still 2 to 3 games worse than over 50 games than those streaks. So like, even when they're like as hot as they are, they don't really hold a candle to those streaks. And I think it just goes to show how incredible they were.
Well, cheers for good winning. I don't want to say streaks, but winning eras, mini eras. Jeers towards trades. You want to talk against trades?
Sure.
Or people's reaction to trades, I should say.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly normal. So like the impetus for this is the Astros on Sunday called up Yordan Alvarez, a 21-year-old out of Cuba. He turns 22 in July, I believe. And he homered in his first game. He led the minors in home runs. He had 23 home runs in AAA. And he's notable from a Dodgers perspective because the Dodgers traded him for Josh Fields, a reliever, at the trade deadline in 2016. So, one of my friends from high school who's from Houston, he lives in Houston now again, and he texted me like 5 times yesterday about Yordan Alvarez, mostly like, hey, thanks for Yordan Alvarez, that kind of a thing. And then once he homered, he like, hey, again, what a great trade. And like people, I saw a couple headlines like, this might be, one of them was so hyperbolic, I almost like, my eyes rolled out of my head. It was so crazy. It was like, this could be one of the worst trades in history. It's like, really? there's no way. Like, first of all, I just want to point this out. Like, I'm against generally the idea of, if you trade anything of value, you failed. Like I think people have insane expectations on trades. I think the entire point of trades is teams, especially when they're at different levels of competition, like if a team sucks and a team that's competing, they're going for different things. So it's natural for the players you traded to develop at some point and like actually be good one day, because that's how baseball works. Like, if you can't expect every trade to be like, get a super productive player for someone who turns into nothing. Like that is not realistic at all. So I'm sort of against that mindset. I think that drives a lot of the, Dodgers really got fleeced, stupid Fields, you know, like they could have had Yordan Alvarez, but like, could they have? Like, sure, they could have. Their development system has been fantastic for, you know, pretty much since Andrew Friedman took over. But that said, like when they traded him, he was 19, right? He had actually not played for the Dodgers at that point. They just signed him out of Cuba that June. Like, he was traded about 6 weeks after they signed him. That was the end of the international signing period in 2015 and 16, when the Dodgers spent like just over $46 million. And then in penalties, they paid another almost $46 million. So they were like right around $92 million in international expenditures back before MLB sort of put the clamps on that. But that was like a way to buy talent. And like, if you look at it, like a team with a financial advantage, as the Dodgers have, major market, all sorts of revenue, the awesome TV deal, that kind of a thing, that's what teams should be doing. Like, if you look at it, if you take the player out of it for a second, the Dodgers paid $2 million for Yordan Alvarez, and then they paid another $2 million in penalty because they were over the limit. So they, it was a, he was a $4 million player, and then they turned around and sold that for, or traded him for Josh Fields. So it, they were in need of relief help that, that year, as they are every year, every team is. And they basically used their cash advantage to buy a reliever for $4 million, roughly. Now, look, obviously, they traded a player. That's what the Astros got out of it. But it's not like he was destined to become great immediately. Like, he was, you know, projectable, but at the same time, he was only 19 and hadn't played in the minors at all. So, like, he developed into what he is now, and it's, like, that happens sometimes. At the same time, the Dodgers, that that same signing period, they paid $2 million for Ronnie Brito, an infielder. So another, he's another $4 million player. They ended up keeping him for a while. They traded him for Russell Martin this winter. He hasn't played in, he was 19 at the time of the trade. He hasn't played higher than high A. They traded O'Neill Cruz that same signing period. They got him that same signing period. They traded O'Neill Cruz in 2017 for Tony Watson. O'Neill Cruz signed for $950,000, so he's a $1.9 million player. He hasn't played higher than high A, so, like, some players will develop, some players won't. That's sort of the nature of baseball. But the fact that, like, that you can already say this trade is, was terrible, is ignoring, like, the facts of it. Like, the Dodgers got what they needed. They, Josh Fields was a perfectly fine reliever. His ERA was under three. His FIP was higher than that, but still, like, very like a normal major league reliever. That said, the one thing that sort of puts a shine on this is that in, like, a critical moment, you know, the Dodgers game two loss, there were so many critical moments in that game two loss in 2017. He had arguably, like, the worst, like, World Series appearance in franchise history.
I was there for that one too. I go to all the greats.
he came in the 10th inning. In a, you know, tie game, the Dodgers, they had to, and it was only in the 10th because Kenley Jansen blew the save, gave up the home run to Marwin Gonzalez. But the 10th inning tie game, Josh Fields starts the 10th, home run, rocket double out of the game. So, miraculously, the Dodgers scored two the bottom of that inning and tied up, and then they lost in the 11th. So that was, like, there's so many, like, nightmare level things that happened in that game. So Josh Fields, very bad in that sense, but mostly, like, serviceable, fine reliever. They released him in spring training this year, rather they paid him, like, a termination fee of his arbitration contract, basically a quarter of it. So, like, look, that's the nature of it. But they got what they needed out of Josh Fields at the time, and the Astros got what they needed, a player to develop, and they developed him. So not every trade's going to work out your favor. Like, look, the Dodgers also traded Chris Taylor for Zach Lee, right? So, like, it's not even that, like, Chris Taylor developed into something he wasn't at the time they traded for him. So the Dodgers don't get all the credit for that trade. Like, they certainly get credit, but there's a lot more than just the trade itself. It's not like they got fleeced one way or fleeced another team the other way. I don't think that's the right way to look at trades, and that's mostly what I have a problem with.
And if we want the Dodgers to get the quality relievers we think they're going to probably need to make this big push, they're going to have to give up something of value. And like you said, it might not develop, but we're going to do it again this year at least once.
Right.
And then they shocked traded, if we don't.
They traded Devin Smeltzer for Brian Dozier last year. Devin Smeltzer had 6 scoreless innings in his major league debut this year. It's not to say they got fleeced on that deal. I'm just saying, like, or not to say that he's going to be some, like, great pitcher, but look, players can be good, like, and still, you know, trade can still serve a purpose. Like, both teams should get something out of every trade. Doesn't have to be a winner loser type thing. That's the whole nature of it. So yeah, I think I'd like to have people think about trades not as a one loss, but as a filling needs of different needs at the time.
Related to this, I'm going to preview your Dodgers rewind now. I'm looking at all of the players at some point Deanna Navarro was traded alongside with or traded for. We've got a who's who's of, like, mid-aughts baseball.
It's a remarkable group. Yeah. He was in some crazy trades.
No, you want to talk about him?
Sure. So we're going early, a little bit early on Dodger Rewind, because
this is my request.
Yeah, it's probably the most. This is a subject we've talked about before. Deonna Navarro was going to be the Dodgers Rewind, but this makes this the most like topical and relevant. Like I think Dodgers Rewind we've had. So Max Muncy yesterday delivered the quote of the year after hitting a solo home run to give the Dodgers a 1-0 win, and it was a splash hit in San Francisco. So Deonna Navarro did that in 2011, his second stint with the Dodgers. It was July 20th, 2011. It was a 1-0 game, and he was actually. We'll get to this in a second, but he was actually released a month later. Like, it's just kind of funny to think about it in that terms. But that year was crazy because so that game was a. This was a peak, almost peak, because Tim Lincecum had won two Cy Youngs already. 2008, 2009, but he was still really good in 2011. Kershaw was winning his first Cy Young in 2011. Those two faced off four times that year. All four were one-run games. The Dodgers won all four. It was just like insane luck, so including the 1-0 game. It was there was the 1-0 game. The other games, all three other games were 2-1. Lincecum's ERA in those games was 1.29, and he was 0-3. A reliever got the loss in the other one. Kershaw was 4-0, and he gave up one earned run, so his ERA was 0.30. Like just insanity, right? But the Deonna Navarro, like a month later, he was released, and then I was reading back at this because I knew there was something about it, and I forgot what it was. But there was Don Mattingly at the time called it philosophical differences and then asked to explain. Don Mattingly is great because he's like a genuinely like nice person and like he's terrible at lying. And like usually if he's covering for something, he'll eventually say what he wants to say because he can't like hold it in. And he doesn't necessarily mean like ill will about it, but you can always sort of read it either on his face or like how he says it or something. But then asked to press, like while it was written, I was looking at the LA Times from 2011. He said, we just didn't feel like D fit into what we were trying to do. I don't want to badmouth D. This is Deonna Navarro, because I like D. He didn't give us any problems in the locker room and he didn't cause us any other problems. And then here's where Mattingly reveals himself. But I'm a guy who believes in work. It's very simple. I believe you have to work. So the obvious implication there is that Deonna Navarro did not work at all. He just, and I think later, I didn't see a quote about it, but I believe Don Mattingly sort of called it physical and mental preparation. So that's as damning as you're ever going to hear Don Mattingly talk about a player. And even though he was like sort of talking about kid gloves, so that was the end of Deonna Navarro's first tour of duty with the Dodgers. His second tour of duty, excuse me. His first tour of duty was like much more famous. Like he came to the Dodgers in the three-team deal that sent Randy Johnson from the Diamondbacks to the Yankees, Navarro from the Yankees to the Dodgers, and Sean Green from the Dodgers to the D-backs. There were a lot more involved in that deal. But if you remember back to that, there was some point where I believe the Dodgers were going to – I can't remember if they were going to get Randy Johnson or if it was another a version of the three-team trade. But there was I actually forget which GM did this, but, like, Paul DePodesta was accused of, like, being in over his head that he backed out of a deal or something, like, that was agreed to. And it did not go over well. But they eventually got a deal done. And there was a lot of other players involved, but Deonna Navarro came to LA in that. So very like sort of a fan figure. 2005 was a nightmare season for the Dodgers. They were imploding. He caught a lot later on in the year. And then he was at some point, he was the number 41 prospect in baseball before 2004. Wasn't quite at that level heading into 2005. But heading into 2006, still relatively young, he and another young guy, Russell Martin, were in like a competition. We'll get to this in a second, but just to cap off Navarro's sort of first tenure in LA. He was actually traded in June 2006 for the immortal, or he was traded with Jay So and Justin Reggiano, who later came back to the Dodgers, as they all do, for Mark Kendrickson and Toby Hall. That was the year where the basically the Dodgers were just had a series of trades of Tampa Bay that were just like, all right, cool. Like, it's just kind of fun to look back at now.
So the Max Muncy thing definitely sort of re-reminded you and me on why we want to talk about Dear Navarro. But the first reason why is this sort of cosmic connection between Dear Navarro and current Dodgers backup catcher Russell Martin and Keibert Ruiz and Will Smith. I've been getting deja vu feelings this entire time on, well, okay, Will Smith's the first one to be called up, but Keibert Ruiz is supposed to be the better prospect. How is that going to shake? Is it going to look exactly like it did, you know, back in 2005, 2006? We're going to have David Hood on the podcast. He might be able to tell us from the prospect perspective, but it really, really struck me at that situation.
No, it was excellent. I'm glad you thought of it because I guess I hadn't made the connection, but you're right. Like, it is like a very good parallel. Like, and after you said it, I was like, oh man, like this is perfect. Like, I think it completely fits. Like, and it was just like fate that Muncy did that yesterday and made Navarro relevant to our interests, so we could talk about him even more. But I was looking this up. So heading into 2006. Martin was drafted in 2003. He was a prospect. He was 22 or 23, excuse me. Navarro was actually still younger. He was 22 at the time. And in spring training, they were competing for the starting catching job. Sandy Alomar Jr. was the Dodgers' backup that year. So they were basically going to go young guy at the catching spot, and whoever won it. Navarro won it, the job in spring training. So they started off Martin in the minors. It was, like, understandable. Navarro had caught for the team, like, at the end of 2005. So it was, like, you know, had some familiarity, and Martin was still, like, a rookie, and they wanted to season him a little more, still, but, like, a relatively highly rated prospect, or enough that they were excited about. Navarro was fine, actually, with the Dodgers, but, like, he got he injured his wrist at the beginning of May. And he went on the disabled list, and they brought up Martin to replace him. And then, like, Martin just kind of took off.
Do you remember the calls for making Russell Martin the Dodgers team captain?
This was
a thing that season.
But it came early. Like,
yes.
Like, and then to just put that in perspective, they haven't had an actual team captain since, like, 1979. I think Davey Lopes was the last one, and the Dodgers were, like, in a struggling year, and he gave up his captaincy because he was so, like, frustrated, I think, that year, and I don't think they've had one since. But, yeah, it's a weird – like, not all teams do it, but it is, like, an honor, you know, like, that certain teams do. But, yeah, so, like, he was – like, from the beginning, like, Russell Martin was like, well, this guy's a leader. Like, you know, like, he's – and even as a rookie, it was, like, pretty obvious. And so – I think that they were like, oh, what we know we got here, like, this is our catcher. And this goes back to, like, the old there's the old phrase of, with, like, catchers and starting quarterbacks, if you have two, you have none. Like, so, like, it's catching is a weird thing. It's hard to do a time split because you're like, you're dealing with pitchers, so there's a little bit of, like, leadership there. And it's hard to probably do that if you're, I'm speaking in total generalities here, but it's harder to do that if you're playing, you know, half the time as opposed to, like, a full time. Not that backups don't have rank, but they're usually, like, more veteran and, have a little more experience, so they can deal with playing less, and they have a little more gravitas to their sort of, contributions to the team. So it's, so the general formula usually is starting catcher, and then some sort of veteran backup catcher in a reduced role. It's rarely two catchers splitting time. Even when, like, Austin Barnes was really good, like, in 2017, he was excellent that year. But Yasmani Grandal still started, like, two-thirds of the games. So, like, there was, like, a line of, definite line of, like, who's our starting catcher, basically. And although Kelly slumped, and then Barnes took over in the playoffs. But the general line of thinking there was, you really can't have, if one guy's your like established like leader, you're not going to want to have someone competing with him. Again, generalities here, but the bottom line is the Dodgers did end up trading Navarro within less than 2 months after Martin made his debut. At some point, Navarro came back from his injury, but they actually optioned him to the minors. Like he didn't play in the majors again until he got traded. And so he was traded to Tampa Bay, and then it was basically Martin, and then like I think Alomar got hurt, and then so it was Martin and Toby Hall for the rest of the year. What a fun thing. But I was looking at the numbers here. That year, Navarro started 23 of the first 29 games, so they were committed to him as a starter. That's a lot. But then Martin started 114 of the last 133. So like whoever they picked as their catcher, man, they were the guy. And I think that's the choice they made. Like, when we got to get something for this guy, because it's not a tenable situation to have two sort of alpha catchers, as it were. Navarro ended up making the All-Star team with the Rays, so it's not like he was bad. But I think it was a situation they didn't want to have that sort of battle. And I think this is where the relevancy comes in with Smith and Ruiz. And part of the reason I like my just general feeling is that I don't think it'll be that type of a situation necessarily. One is there's like a good age difference between the two. Like Will Smith is already 24. And his birthday is March 28th. So I'll always root for him. That's my birthday. But like, no, just in general, he's 24. Kiber is still 20. He doesn't turn 21 until July 20th. So there's more of an age gap there. Kiber's farther along than Smith was, but that's because Smith was drafted out of college. Like, so like Smith was still at Louisville at this time when he was Kiber's age, where Ruiz is like holding his own in Double A. He's not like lighting the world on fire or anything, but he's like fine. Look, he's a switch hitting catcher with pop and a good arm. So like he's been rated the higher prospect of the two. I think it's probably more due to his bat, but also like because he plays catcher, and as long as he can like hold his own, that's a very valuable person to have. But I think with Ruiz, like I think his bat is supposed to be good enough, at least in theory, that like if it gets to the point where he comes up and it's a competition between the two, Smith and Ruiz, I think Ruiz is someone where you could play him at first base or something like that, like a lot of times to like actually get his bat into the lineup. And then he could still catch like a third of the time. This is a speculation. He might grow out of the position. Who knows? But I think that's sort of where they're at. So I think it's a situation that could be, they could work together, but I don't think it's something we have to necessarily have to worry about for the foreseeable future. Like, Smith's on the 40. They're both on the 40 man now, so like both, like they're both probably be up in September, I would imagine. And what I would mention about Ruiz, like while he's not really hitting, like he hasn't really hit a ton for power, but he still has like 19 walks and 11 strikeouts, so like his plate coverage is great. But even with Double A in Tulsa, he's caught 37 games and he's DH'd 11 times. So like even there, like they're letting him bat in games where he's not catching. So they like his bat, and I think that's a situation that could possibly happen with the Dodgers. But I'm looking at, he's in Double A now. Reasonable. He ended the year last year in Double A. So I think it's reasonable that Ruiz will be in Triple A at some point this year. And it probably would be tied to like if Smith got promoted again, if something were to happen. So maybe that's part of it, or maybe that's what we see in August or something with Triple A Oklahoma City, that Smith and Ruiz start to share at catcher, and then maybe we'll see from there if Ruiz plays DH or maybe first base or something on occasion. Maybe we'll see what the plans are if they do have to share at that point. But I don't think it's reasonable outside of a September call up to expect Ruiz to be in the majors until like mid next year at best, mid 2020, and like, he turns 22 in July next year. So like even that's like a remarkable like achievement if he made the majors before he turned 22 or as he turned 22. So like that's a reasonable assumption for me. And I think by then, like, Will Smith will have more experience and he'll be 25. So I don't think it's necessarily a situation that you have to, like, deal one of them right away, especially if Ruiz is bad, is good enough where he could play other positions. So, and we've seen at times too, like, Will Smith has played third. Not that the Dodgers necessarily want to move all of them around, but if they had to, I think they could play. I think there's room to find for both of them, not necessarily, you know, to start next season or something, but I think it's something they could definitely work with.
And, you know, it may come July 2020. You and I are laughing at this because the Dodgers make some blockbuster deal that had to involve one of them. So,
right. Like, who knows? Let's say, Rich Hill went down or something and they're not comfortable with Urias starting, like, the rest of the year, or maybe they don't want to have Stripling. Maybe they want to upgrade a starting pitcher or something at the trade deadline. That puts him in the market for, like, a Noah Syndergaard. And then maybe they have to deal Kyber Ruiz in that deal. That obviously could happen. I think everything's in play. And it gives the Dodgers options, right? Like, if they need some bigger package, Ruiz gives them the sort of cachet to make that type of a deal, but also it gives them the opportunity to keep him and still have a talented player around who's probably going to be in the majors at some point next year. So, it's a good place to be in, I think, if the Dodgers.
Okay, we're running short on time, and we got questions to do. I do have one more note, one quick note on Dionervar. We move on. In 2013, he was the starting catcher for the Toronto Blue Jays, but then was demoted to backup in the offseason when the Blue Jays signed Russell Martin. So,
you see, it's perfect. What a cosmic. Life comes full circle.
We've got a couple of questions from Sissy.
Oh, sorry. Before we go into questions,
yes,
more Blue Jays talk. But also, quick, before Blue Jays talk, Russell Martin, John Suhu tweeted out a pic today of Russell Martin and backup catcher Brad Ausmus with the Dodgers, I believe, in from 2009 or 10. Mm-hmm. And then the Dodgers are playing the Angels tonight, and Brad Ausmus is managing the Angels, and Martin is on the Dodgers. So it's Russell Martin is like the link to the past for so many things. But back to the Blue Jays for a second. They signed old friend Edwin Jackson a month ago. He's made 5 starts with them. His ERA is 11.90. It's not good. He had a blow up start in Coors where he gave up 10 runs in 2 1/3. So even if you take that start away, his ERA is 8.31. He's allowed 6 runs or more in his last 4 starts. Opposing batters are hitting 383, 442, 787.
Those are
787 slugging percentage.
Cody Bellinger numbers.
My note here is better than Cody Bellinger and Christian Yelich at this point. So, like, but the best part is he's starting, I believe, Wednesday for the Blue Jays. And when asked why Jackson is remaining in the rotation, Charlie Montoya, the manager of the Blue Jays, on Sunday said, quote, "We don't have anybody else." So if Max Muncy didn't get the quote of the year, that might have been the quote of the year. Okay, so now I'm ready for questions. Sorry.
Okay. Sissy Tran has a couple of questions. When was the last time a pitcher started on his own bobblehead night? You and I talked about this. We have no clue.
Yeah, I don't know how to look this up. It's a great question, but, like, I wish there was, like, a database I knew of that had – even if there was it'd be tough to cross-reference, like, with starts. Like, or I guess you could look up one by one, but it's kind of hard to do. But I just don't know of a database that exists like this. But the reason it was brought up is because Joe Kelly, although not a starter now, they signed him in the offseason. He has a bobblehead giveaway on this Thursday, and it's, like, so unfortunate. Like, that, because he's been the whipping boy in terms of, like, fan reaction. He's been very bad. He's been better of late, but, like, just generally been bad this year. I know he almost had a 4 strikeout inning in San Francisco over the weekend, but he had a strikeout and then a wild pitch strikeout and then another strikeout, but then the last out of the inning, I believe, was a flyout. So he missed history. But yeah, other than that, Joe Kelly hasn't been super impressive, but he's still getting a bobblehead, and it'll be interesting to see how the fans react to that, especially – if he comes in to pitch and doesn't pitch well. But they haven't really been putting him in high leverage situations at all. So I don't think it's going to come to that, where the worst case scenario is you envision fans throwing the Joe Kelly bobblehead onto the field. Like
pretzel day.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't think it's going to come to that.
Poor Whitey Ford. Second question. Speaking of which, what are your thoughts on throwing the ball back?
Oh, man.
You can do it at Wrigley. Don't do it anywhere else. That's my...
What's funny on this is that when you said, speaking of that, I was like, did she send a Whitey Ford question? But, you're right. It's a tradition at Wrigley. Everywhere else, shut your mouth. Like, you just sort of keep the ball.
And even at Wrigley, if, say, either if a kid catches this, and this happened at, I think, Dodger Stadium, a kid catches it, or just someone who's like, hey, this is a really special moment for me. Maybe it's a member of a fan of the other team. Do not admonish the person for wanting to keep the ball.
Right. Just let them. Just like it's a souvenir. It's a cool souvenir. Like I've never got a foul ball or something in a game, or a home run ball. My friend Tom Bingham in high school, we went to the Dodgers Braves in 91. It was a Friday night September game in a pennant race. Ron Gant, he was sitting on 29 home runs and he had 30 steals. He was going to be the second back-to-back 30-30 player ever. The only other one was Willie Mays, so it was a big deal at the time. And we were sitting in the left field pavilion. He hit a home run right to us. And my friend Tom got his hands on the ball on the fly. He didn't bring a glove, but was pushed in the back like as he was catching it. So he dropped it, and then the ball was like in a crazy scrum. And like I forgot who got it, but it wasn't Tom. It wasn't me. But so we missed out on a little bit of history there. But, yeah, if you get a ball, keep it. My thing is if I'm at Wrigley or if I'm in a situation where the tradition is to throw it back, I take a ball with me. I sneak it in if I have to, if they can't get it back. That way I throw the bad ball back and I keep the actual ball.
Smart.
Because I'm keeping it.
All right. Five questions from Craig. I'm going to do this lightning round style. You ready?
Yes.
There was a time when I listened to lots of sports talk radio. Today, not so much. But I remember calling Chick Kern on Lakers line and asking him a question. I don't remember the question, but Chick didn't say it was stupid, so that was a win for me. What are your memories of sports talk radio, and did you have any favorites?
So there's a couple things set up. The fact that he brought up Chick Hearn, I remember those post games. You don't see that a ton these days where the lead announcer is the guy answering questions like on a post game thing. Although Ross Porter did it for years with the Dodgers, and the thing that sticks in my head is Ross was like this very like a Southern drawl to him a little bit that came out a lot during these questions, but he was very laid back. And he just listened to the person talk, and as they're like asking, Ross would be like, like, and he would just like sort of hum like in the background. So that was cool. For me, I'm the same. I don't really listen to a ton of sports talk radio anymore. I really like Ryan Russillo a lot, and he's probably the only like national guy I'll even listen to at this point. I did listen to sports talk radio for a lot of years. My first exposure to it, I think, was in high school. And I don't even know how I started this, but there was a syndicated show that's actually still going. It's called Sports Byline USA, and Ron Barr is the host. He was the host then, and so this was like 92 to 94 when I was in high school. And then he's still the host now. I would occasionally listen to that like while I was going to sleep or trying to go to sleep or something. But I did call in once. I don't remember what the subject was. I think I made a stupid joke, and I was nervous to be on the air. But yeah, I'm generally not a call-in guy, but I kind of felt compelled to do it or something at the time. But yeah, it was a fun, like, I liked listening to it. And that was probably my first exposure to sports talk radio. What about you?
I generally like it until they start taking calls, and then too many of the call-ins I get mad at. I remember in the Juan Pierre era, people kept asking, why did they just move him to shortstop, the left-handed Juan Pierre? And it's Ken Levine and
Josh Shushan?
Yes, Josh Shushan, who just like kept taking that question because they loved just pointing out how ridiculous it was. So,
I really enjoyed the Ken Levine era. on Dodger Talk because he's a longtime comedy writer, award-winning comedy writer, playwright.
True story. Kind of he credits himself, so and I assume it's valid for coining the isotopes,
right? Yes, absolutely.
In The Simpsons, so which is my bar trivia name. So thank you, thanks, Ken.
And it was like, but the point, like, he came at it from a funny perspective, and I always appreciated that. Like, it was a good contrast because, like, Sushant's very professional, a former reporter. Now he's an announcer with the Isotopes, actually, who are now a Rockies affiliate, but used to be a Dodgers affiliate. But yeah, they were a great pair. I really enjoyed them together.
If you were recording this on Monday, June 10th, we are. Dave Roberts' managerial record is currently 332-222. If the Dodgers win tonight, he'd have a 600 winning percentage. I know Eric has talked about this before, but again, what do you think Roberts' strengths are, and have you noticed anything different in how he is handling this 2019 Dodger team?
This year's been weird for me because I haven't personally been to the stadium a ton. So I don't have as good of like perspective on this, at least from what he's been doing this year. I saw a little bit in spring training, but I think it's all mostly the same, for him. He's like, I don't know, generally like a pretty good communicator. Like, I think people focus a lot on like, lineups and X's and O's. He generally plays the right people. Like, I think the players for the most part know where they stand with him, and I think that's sort of important. But he's pretty good at like keeping like locker room stuff down. Like it doesn't really, you don't see a ton of that like happening with the Dodgers. Not that it doesn't happen, because it's bound to happen over the course of a season, but he's pretty good about like keeping focus like on the big picture. So he's had as good of a run like as you could hope for, like NLCS, World Series, like in his first 3 years. So like that, it's a pretty good start. And so he has like a confidence about him. It's not like cockiness necessarily, but I think like the players like trust him. And like, I think the fact that he's earned that goes a long way.
And this gets brought up a lot, whether it's in newspapers or actually on the air with Joe Davis, but being able to do that with how often the Dodgers change people around and do platoons, to just have all that big buy-in says a lot about him and says a lot about sort of the Dodgers organization and training organization as well. That just right, from an organizational level, there's buy-in.
Good or bad. I think it's always like a good thing that the manager and the general manager or the front office or whatever are on the same page. Like, look, sometimes it'll be for the wrong reason or something, but I think as long as those two like factions are working in concert and have a good working relationship, like that's a good foundation. Even if you might not agree with everything they do, because like we saw this, we talked about 2005, that team like imploded. And a lot of it just got much worse because Jim Tracy and Paul DePodesta like hated each other, and like they were like openly working against each other, and that's terrible for like a franchise. Like, that'll set you back. So anytime you can have sort of harmony, I know the criticism of Roberts is that he's a puppet for the front office and he doesn't make the lineups. I think that's absurd. But the fact is he does have a relationship. He's sitting on the front lines talking to reporters every day, so he does have to take a lot of the heat for some organization stuff. But I think that's part of the modern like managerial job these days. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think Roberts is as good at that as I've seen. So yeah. And he's good at like getting the message across. I'll say that, like, not that he's like devious or something, but like, I think he's on board with whatever the Dodgers are doing, and I think that comes through with how he sort of carries himself.
The Dodgers have 26 games left until the All-Star break. They are 45-21, which is the best record after 66 games for the Dodgers, LA Dodgers, I should say, right now with an 11-game lead. Tell me the Dodgers' record at the All-Star break, and how big or small will their lead be at that time?
So, I looked this up, and the Dodgers have a very favorable schedule heading into the All-Star break. They play 26 games, like Craig mentioned. this week they are at the Angels for two and then host the Cubs for four. After that, it's all divisional till the break. So
not a good division.
Yeah, exactly. So I was looking at this. It's seven games with the Rockies, who are the best other team, in my opinion. They had a very terrible start, but they've been great since. So they're going to be the most formidable opponent. But the Dodgers have 17 home games and nine road games. Two of the nine road games are in Anaheim, so not really road games. Like right now, the Dodgers, they came home Sunday night. They're going to be in their own beds for 14 straight days. So like that's always good. The Dodgers are 25-7 at home. That's the best. They're 17-7 versus the West. That's the best divisional record in the NL. So I was looking at this. I think the Dodgers will go 18-8 in the 26 games. So that puts them at 63-29. And I looked this up. That's only been topped in franchise history by the 1942 team, which was 65-27. And that team won 104 games back in 154 game schedule, but they still didn't go to the World Series because the Cardinals won 106. So bummer for them. But then the 55 Dodgers in Brooklyn were 63-29. And then in 2017, the Dodgers were also 63-29. But my favorite part about this, 2017, the Dodgers were 63-29. And then right after it wasn't the break necessarily, but after the 92nd game, they followed that by going 24-5 in their next 29 games. What a ridiculous team that was. My God.
I'm much more bullish than you. I think they'll go 19 wins, so 64-28.
Much more.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking of this. So like there's three four-game series and two-game series. So if they win every series, so three out of four of every four, and if they win if they sweep both two-game series, I believe that's that's 20-6. Don't quote me on this. It might be 19-7. But yeah, so like maybe it's 20-6. But yeah, so they're in good shape, I think, with the schedule, at least going into the break. So, oh yeah, so the lead, they're, what is it currently, 11?
11.
15. Because they're playing the division, yeah, I think they play the Rockies seven times, so maybe they only go 4-3 against them. But I'll say, I think it's going to be a 14-game lead at the break.
15. Got to be excited.
Well, it looks like 15 because
Corey Seager is turning the corner. I'm cutting you off. The corner on this on his season. Doc has moved him around the lineup a bit. Where do you see his best spot right now? And will he eventually go back to the number two spot in the lineup?
I did some research on this. He's like played all over, basically like second to sixth. Like he did start at seventh once against the lefty. But his most are at second, 20 times. I do think eventually he ends up back at second. I was looking at this, like, against righties at least, like his last seven starts against lefties have been fifth, sixth or seventh. So, earlier in the year, he was like batting second against them and maybe third a couple times. But so my sort of lineup against righties, I think I'd go, Jock, Seager, Turner, Bellinger, Muncy. Muncy's been hitting second a lot, but I think with his power, like maybe put him behind Bellinger and then, like, have him drive in some runs that way. But then against lefties, Muncy has more power, and he's actually been hitting lefties well. Seager hasn't been hitting lefties so well, so I would drop him to sixth against lefties. And then so my lineup against lefties is basically Kike or whoever they have in that sort of other slot, the right-handed leadoff guy. And then Muncy second in this case, then Turner, Bellinger, another right-hander, and then Seager. So like, that keeps them against lefties from having
two. Have you met this player, David Freese?
No, right, exactly.
I think your other right-hander is what I was getting at, yeah.
But yeah, I think it depends. Like, so, like if it's like Kike, maybe Kike would have to be in center and Muncy at second. But yeah, they'll, like you said, it's flexibility. It gives them the options. But yeah, I do think Seager's ultimate place is going to be second in the lineup with Turner third and Bellinger fourth, and like everything around it figures itself out. But yeah, but I do think he's going to be in that second slot, but also six against lefties.
Final question. Describe the best way to construct a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Peanut butter on one side, jelly, preferably a berry on the other side, put them together, done.
Yeah, I can hang with creamy peanut butter, but my favorite is extra crunchy.
Weirdo.
I know. But yeah, Craig, I think asked him this too. If you do it different, like if you spread peanut butter and jelly on different bread, and my first thought was, of course you do. I'm not a savage. Like I spread peanut butter on one piece of bread, jelly on the other, and then I slam them together like a champ. Yeah.
American.
I don't know if there's a reason for this. I tend to do peanut butter first, and then I know that the knife gets weird with peanut butter because it sticks to it. Jelly does too, but not so much. But I think it's easier to wipe the excess peanut butter on the knife onto the other slice of bread, and then use it. I don't use two knives. I am a Spartan in this scenario. I use the same knife for the jelly after I've bread wiped it, and then put it all together.
Well, that's the episode. Jam-packed.
I think I'm gonna. I think I'm gonna go have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich right now.
That sounds pretty
good. Everyone, I hope you enjoy a peanut butter and jelly sandwich while you're listening to this. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.